Okay, it is 9:45. Let's please move to item 77.
Accept the City of Portland Comprehensive Annual Financial Report for fiscal year ended June 30, 2015.
Mr. Rust and his team are here. I trust everyone has read this document cover to cover. It's extensive and important. So with that, I'll turn this over to our Chief Financial Officer, Ken Rust, his partners. Welcome.
Good morning, Mayor Hales and members of the City Council. For the record, my name is Ken Rust. I'm the City's Chief Financial Officer and Director of the Bureau of Financial Services. Joining me this morning on my left is City Controller Michelle Kirby, and on my right is my assistant, Vicki Rice. She has the most important job. She's going to man the computer and run the PowerPoint presentation for me. Today, we'll be presenting to you the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, or CAFR, for the fiscal year ending June 30th, 2015. We will also be discussing with you key findings from the CAFR document, along with additional information regarding the city's long-term fiscal health. At this time, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Michelle.
Morning.
Morning.
The production of the CAFR document is a significant undertaking for the city, and it involves many individuals around the city, and that includes virtually all city bureaus, our auditor's office, and the independent auditors, Moss Adams. The group that spends the most significant amount of time and has the responsibility for the CAFR production is the Central Accounting Division, and there's a core team of accountants in that division who spend many, many hours getting this document to be the quality that it is. Several of them are in attendance today, and if you don't mind, I'd like to just have them stand up and be recognized
Please.
For a moment.
Good morning.
Thank you
very much. We'll suspend the rules and thank our staff.
Thank you very much. So this year's CAFR was completed by December 1st. This is very significant in that it's the earliest it's been produced since 2006. Previously, it's been up to 180 days or pushing towards December 31st. This is also notable due to a large GASB implementation this year that you'll be hearing more about. So over the past few years, there's been an increasing demand for more timely reporting by the investment community. So under the leadership of our CFO, we've created an escalated schedule over the next few years to push back the finalization date. So for the current year, 2016, we have a goal of December 15th. And then the following year, November 15th, excuse me. And then the following year would be November 1st or 120 days. And so while the earlier timing isn't mandated at this time, we feel that we're positioning ourselves to be ready and proactive for when this does occur. So the CAFR document basically tells the citizens where we've been financially at a certain point in time, and that is our fiscal year end, June 30th. These statements are prepared on the generally accepted accounting principles as issued by the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, or GASB. So there's many rules and regulations we need to follow when we are preparing the document. And then it's subject to external audit by our auditors, Moss Adams, and they offer an opinion that the statements are free of material misstatement. And so the good news is that the auditors gave a clean opinion. It's also called unmodified opinion, which is a clean opinion, and that's the best possible. And they will talk more after us about the results of the audit, but it is good news. Also good news is that fund balances continue to grow, and in fact, the general fund balance increased by $9 million over the prior year. And each year, the city submits the CAFR document to the GFOA for review in their program, which is Excellence in Financial Reporting, and the city did receive the award for Excellence in Financial Reporting for the 35th consecutive year. And this really demonstrates the professionalism and excellence that the city maintains in providing financial information. There is some not so good news, and that is that on a full accrual gap basis, the governmental activities net position has declined, and in fact, it is now at a negative $1.2 billion. And this primarily is due to the implementation of that GASB I mentioned a few minutes ago, which is GASB 68, and it's the pension reporting standard that was implemented this past year. And so Ken is going to talk more about that, and so I'm going to turn it over to Ken now.
Thanks, Michelle. The next slide in our presentation gets into this net position question. It's something we've talked with you about the last couple years and thought it would be good to refresh ourselves what's going on here. And just as a reminder, the financial net position represents the city's assets minus its liabilities. So the chart I have here tries to break down what increases and what decreases our net position. So factors that can decrease net position, and by that were expenses exceed revenues on a generally accepted accounting principles basis, are things like increases in our pension liabilities. So if we have an increase in our PERS liability or FPD&R liability, that can decrease our net position. When we issue bonds but we don't have an asset that offsets those bonds, that can decrease net position. And another item that affects us is where we have depreciation, which is a non-cash expense. If that exceeds the new investment in our capital infrastructure, that can lead to a decline in our net position. Conversely, there are items that can increase our net position. So, for example, when we receive grant funds for capital projects, we get money in, we build an asset, the asset's on our balance sheet, our net position goes up. If we fund capital improvements from our current cash flow as opposed to borrowing, that can have a benefit of increasing our net position. And finally, if we have surplus revenues that we retain as a reserve, or we use those monies to pay down liabilities, that can also increase our net position. So those are some of the factors that are both pluses and minuses for us.
So Ken, if you don't mind, let me stop you and get you to elaborate, or maybe you were going to anyway, on some of those issues, because I think when we take these reports, the council and the city staff are very well aware of some of the particulars that drive these bottom line numbers, but I think there are people in the community, including even some in the news media, that don't necessarily understand the drivers of this. And let me make sure I've got this right in terms of restating it. And that is, in terms of the city's PERS liability, we are on a pay-as-we-go basis. That is, we budget each year for the city's contributions to PERS. So although that burden is rising, because the cost of PERS is rising, it is fully funded each year by appropriations of the council and the budget process. I think that's true.
I think what you're referencing, Mayor, is the FPD&R liability.
Well, I want to talk about FPD&R as well, but in terms of PERS, it's a check we write each year to the state,
correct,
to pay for our PERS obligations, and it's pay as we go. And FPD&R, as I understand it, the change in the GASB rules treats our FPD&R liability as less fully funded than we consider it to be. And that is, we know that we have a tax levy that is authorized to pay for that pension liability for FPD&R Tier 1 retirees. We know there's a curve in which that total burden rises to a certain point and then falls, because that's a closed group of retirees. And our current projections are we will not hit the ceiling of the levy amount that we're allowed to collect from the taxpayers in order to pay that pension liability. So one could, in lay terms, as I usually do, describe that pension liability as funded. It is not unfunded. In the usual understanding of that term around the country, when people look at cities with big unfunded pension liabilities, they're talking about cities that actually have no plan or mechanism by which to pay those liabilities, where we do. Is that a correct non-GASPY restatement of where we stand.
That's a pretty good summary, Mayor, and I'm going to get into a lot of those details in my presentation.
Okay.
And hopefully good. To you and the audience and others that are watching this, it will become a little bit clearer about how there's differences between GAAP accounting and then some of the key underpinnings of our financial system that we pay attention to and what that means for us.
Good, because it's been a source of considerable jubilation on the FPD&R board to see our forecast fall below that ceiling over the last couple of years. And Sam Hutchison and the folks there deserve credit for good management. And the economy deserves credit for lifting us high enough that we don't have that problem.
I'm going to show you a little bit of the trend that we've been seeing in this net position figure. And the chart in front of you has three lines on it. The blue line represents what's called governmental activities, which is predominantly our general fund-related programs and transportation. The orange line represents our business activities, and those are largely water and environmental services. And the green line is simply the summation of both of those lines. And what you'll note is that the trend overall is negative, and it's really influenced entirely by the trend line in governmental activities. And the downward trend over the years has been a reflection of more of the liability associated predominantly with FPD&R coming onto our balance sheet. You'll notice the big decline this year is the full implementation of what's called GASB 68, which requires us to put all of that liability onto our balance sheet. So last year when I spoke to you, our governmental activities net position was about $212 million. Now it's negative $1.2 billion. That's virtually all the result of implementing this new GASB standard. So that's been the trend that we've been observing, we've been discussing it with you, and have been describing what's going on with that. And what's really causing that, and Mayor, you've mentioned that some of those things already, a big part of it is the treatment of pension liabilities. So we're required under GASB and GAAP accounting to place all of that liability onto our balance sheet. That currently is about $2.9 billion for FPD&R. However, we receive a value of $0 for the future property tax revenues that we will be receiving that are dedicated and can only be used to pay the FPD&R liability. So on the one hand, we've recognized all the liability. On the other hand, we put a zero value on that future revenue stream. A portion of the bonds that we have issued that the liability sits on our balance sheet also don't reflect the fact that we give that money away. So for example, we have $500 million of short and long-term debt that we issue and give those proceeds to PDC. That's how tax increment financing works. That's how the Constitution requires us to issue bonds and give proceeds to the redevelopment agency. Liabilities on our balance sheet, assets are somewhere else. So that creates this decline in net position. We've also, over the years, we have a couple other deals where we've given money to other governments. So for example, when we did the convention center financing back in 2001, we gave $100 million of bond proceeds to Metro to build the expansion of the convention center. In exchange, we get revenues, but the liabilities on our balance sheet, no offsetting asset. And we're currently funding for Multnomah County a portion of the reconstruction of the Selwood Bridge. That liability also sits on our balance sheet. Another piece of the puzzle is depreciation. I mentioned that earlier. Depreciation is a non-cash expense associated with the wearing out of our assets over time using an accounting life and a matching concept. Last year, our depreciation for governmental activities totaled about $187 million. We invested about $134 million, so we had a shortfall. All of that shortfall is a result of what's going on inside of PBOT. PBOT had $161 million of depreciation expense. They only put about $51 million of new capital into the ground. They were negative $110. And what's really interesting about PBOT is that, let's say, for example, that we wanted to make that even. We wanted to reduce that shortfall of $110 million. And so we invested $110 million and we filled potholes and we, you know, put new street services on and we maybe built a couple new roads. If we don't spend it on the right kind of thing, it won't balance. So for example, if we build a new road, add a new lane mile, add something that we can capitalize in our books and records, that would count against being able to bring us closer to depreciation and investment. If we simply do things like fill a pothole, repave a street, and don't do enough work on it to rebuild it, that's maintenance, doesn't count. So there's a nature of the way we measure things also affects this net position issue. So all of those things.
Just to elaborate on that, I mean, the ridiculous result of that is if we build new roads, which means that we're taking on a new long-term maintenance expense, we're in better position in terms of the accounting rules than if we did what's actually the more fiscally prudent thing, which is to repair existing roads.
Unfortunately, from a strictly accounting point of view, it could lead you to coming up with the wrong answer. And that's why it's important to understand really what's going on here and what we should be doing.
And let me just make sure we all understand what GASB 68 is and why it applies to us. So you've explained this anomaly where we have a pay-as-you-go system where we're now required to book the liability but not any of the future revenue stream to cover that liability under our charter. What is the purpose of GASB 68? What's the vice they're trying to cure by having us put this in the books in this manner?
I'll give you my opinion, Michelle, and Moss Adams, that auditor, when Jim Lanzarotta may have some other views.
Well, we have the senator that actually proposed legislation. No, kidding. But what? So what's because there's obviously some principle underlying this, even though it produces an anomaly for us.
I think the largest concern is that there's been a sense that for municipal governments like Portland, that there hasn't been an accurate characterization and capturing of liabilities like pension liabilities and having that liability be appropriately reflected on our financial statements. For years, those things would show up as a footnote if you're underfunded, and then we've been, over time, bringing more of those liabilities onto the balance sheet. And I think a lot of concerns that there have been across the country were investors making decisions about a particular community's bonds and things like that. They're not seeing the whole picture of the kinds of things that could impair their financial condition over time. And so there's a sense that that more of that needs to be brought onto the balance sheet and made it comport more with what's happening in the corporate world.
But the thing, I guess, that's unique in this circumstance is that since our pension plan is not, you know, the typical plan that's funded and then from those resources we pay out benefits, it's secured against the assets of the city and it's a pay-as-you-go. This idea of funded or unfunded doesn't quite apply to our pension.
That's correct.
So in any event, we weren't keeping some unfunded liability off the books because that's not how we structure our pension. It's a pay-as-you-go, secured against the assets of the city, and subject to an increase in a revenue stream that the charter and the people of Portland have agreed to.
Yeah, in fact, we are by charter not allowed to fund benefits when they're earned. We are not allowed to have assets greater than $750,000. So we're doing all the things that we're required to do under charter, but we are anomalous in the sense of the way accounting views the nature of that liability and the character of the asset that we have as a receivable. And I'm going to show you a little bit about what that means, because what I've done is restated net position from a GAAP basis to something that's not GAAP. You can call it Ken accounting, or you can call it some other kind of accounting. What it tries to do is tease out those things that are unique positives to us from a financial position point of view, and to give a more, I think, full view of the financial condition of the city at this point in time. So, for example, the three things I've done to adjust net position to give you that different view includes putting the value of the tax receivable we have for FBR back onto our balance sheet. So basically, we net out that $2.9 billion liability with the present value of our future receivable, which is greater than $2.9 billion. Voila, that falls off the balance sheet. We have the bonds that we've issued for urban renewal and PDC, for example. We know in talking with PDC that about 25% of the $500 million has come back to the city in some form as an asset. So if I reduce that and recognize the fact that when we create urban renewal districts, we receive tax revenues that we otherwise would not have received and could not spend for any other purpose, that liability vanishes as well. And also then looking at the convention center transaction, that's backed by an intergovernmental agreement with Metro and Multnomah County. We receive tax revenues from them to pay debt service on the bonds. We've always paid debt service on those bonds. We basically have a receivable that exists for the life of those bonds. So that liability doesn't create any impairment to us as well. So when I make adjustments like that, what you see is that the trend, the blue line in governmental activities, is slightly down but mostly flat. business activities continues to grow because we're making regular investments in the infrastructure, and our overall net position is on a slight increasing point of view. And that's really the view that the rating agencies and investors look at.
So that you just anticipated the two questions I wanted to ask you. But go back to GASB for a second. If we had a fully funded pension and it was structured differently by law, then the asset and the liability would match up and it would have no impact on our net asset condition. Because that's a pay-as-you-go, we're by definition not going to have something to compensate for the liability. Does GASB have a philosophical problem with the way we structure our pension, or is that just the consequence of how it's administered?
I would say it's just the consequence of how it's administered. The standard is broad. It applies to, you know, pensions that typically work a certain way. We're an anomaly, and the rule is it doesn't have exceptions for anomalies like Portland. So we struggle with that.
But there's nothing that we know of in GASB that says our way of funding a pension is somehow out of step with prudent accounting principles.
Well, it's not how you would structure a traditional pension plan. Right. I mean, there is a strong sense that as you earn pension benefits, you should fund those pension benefits, and that makes a more sense both in terms of staying current with that obligation and also making sure that the people who are benefiting from those services are paying for those services.
Right.
We don't have that system, but we have, and I think if you didn't have a dedicated tax levy, you could argue that you're pushing that liability further and further into the future, but we have the dedicated tax levy.
And I guess the second question that you were about to get to is we covet our credit ratings, which is for obvious reasons because it allows us to borrow money at favorable rates. And we have very high credit ratings in the city. It allows us to borrow money dirt cheap, and it's one of the reasons we've been able to do a lot of long-term capital projects at a very favorable cost. Does this adjustment have an impact in how the rating agencies view our financial health?
No, because, in fact, that's the adjustment that they're making. They recognize that, particularly with the FPNR liability, that it's an anomaly. They've looked at it for many years. Before there was a GASB 68, the city's had a AAA bond rating since about 1976. This is not a new phenomena, and they're very comfortable with the way in which we fund this and also the integrity of that tax levy, because really the key is that tax levy sufficient to pay all obligations when due? That gets tested regularly, and in fact, I'm going to talk a little bit about that. If anything, that's on an improving trend because of the underlying nature upon which that tax levy is based. So in my opinion, it's well understood by the investor community the nature of how we pay for this pension liability, and that really isn't a problem or an issue in terms of our ratings. So I'd like to talk about because we're kind of getting to that, what does this mean and what should we do? The issues we have around GAAP accounting isn't that it's wrong, it's that there are things that we have undertaken from a financial point of view and the unique parts of the city of Portland that don't get reflected under GAAP accounting. And so adjusting things like that, I think, give you a more realistic view of our current condition. And if you don't do that, you really end up with a situation where you could focus on the wrong thing. So, for example, if you didn't tease out some of this and go, my goodness, we have an FPNR problem, maybe we should be doing something and putting more general fund money to pay FPNR, you could reach that conclusion. When in fact, FPNR is really not a problem. What's a problem is we should be investing more in infrastructure, and we've had that discussion last year about what we do with that. So I think by restating the information, if you will, you can get to what we should be doing. And that's really one of the problems that we have is the CAFR provides us a lot of information, but it's a point-in-time piece in terms of what it's telling us, and it may not be telling us the right things that we should be worrying about going forward. And I want to talk a little bit about what those things are as well, because one of the things I've been tasked with is, what should we be worrying about? What are those things coming at us beyond this point in time with the CAFR that we should be looking at? So over the course of the last year, I've been investigating that with my staff and have put together what I call this little snapshot about things that are that we should be worried about. And I broke it into three categories: our long-term liabilities, our infrastructure, and employee costs. And I've given, you know, my view of what I think those things look like on a current status basis and also what they might look like in the future and some comments about trends. So, for example, PERS liability. I view it in negative status, and I think it's going to stay that way. Why? We just received in November an update from PERS on our actuarial status, and it reflects the overturning of the Morrow decision. So our unfunded liability with PERS has increased from $40 million to $365 million. Furthermore, we know that PERS has to earn at least 7.5% to stay even. In fact, it's probably greater than that. Well, what happened in 2015? They earned 1.88%, almost 6 percentage points below their target number. What does that mean to the city? That's going to be another $9 million ongoing coming to us. The $365 million, to unwind that's about $30 million. So we have $39 million more costs coming our way. FPDNR, we've talked a lot about that levy. I have it in green status. Why? Because it is sufficient to pay our obligations when due. The real market value increases means that the capacity of that tax levy is increasing as well. So I feel very comfortable. I'm more comfortable with FPDNR than with PERS. Another piece of our long-term liabilities that deals with other post-employment benefits. This is a requirement to look at the cost of providing a subsidy to retirees under our health care plan until they reach Medicare eligibility at age 65. We looked at that in 2008 when we were first required to report that under GASB 45. We said we think we should not do anything. We should continue the pay-as-you-go that we're using with that. We looked at it again last year. That liability is really unchanged, and our recommendation is the same. Watch it, but don't do anything different. Infrastructure. Over the next 5 years, we probably have at least $1 billion of infrastructure needs coming our way. A lot of that is in water and environmental services, and I have confidence that their funding model of rates and borrowings will be sufficient. My only concern there is that rates are high and capacity that is more stressed than it otherwise would be, but we have a funding plan, and that funding plan has worked quite well.
So, Ken, I had a spirited discussion with Fred about this because to me, this is more green than yellow, and I want to just put something in context. Just this past week, there was a national survey that was released of trends in our public utilities. And the thing that jumped out at me was the enormous benefit that has accrued to us by taking care of some regulatory costs ahead of the curve. And I'm particularly, of course, talking about the CSO requirements, the combined sewer overflow. We did a very expensive big pipe project, but we did it in the past, and cities like Atlanta and other cities are catching up and having to do it at a time when it's going to be a lot more expensive. One of the things that struck me was the comparison of the impact on rates on a family of four in three sample cities, and they looked at four sample cities, Seattle, San Francisco, Atlanta, and Portland. And we don't necessarily think of those as sister cities, but at least Seattle and Atlanta are comparable in population. And what was just astonishing to me, that a family of four in those cities, those other three cities, would pay two or three times more monthly for the combined water, sewer, stormwater services. That doesn't mean that we're not charging, you know, that our rates are not a burden for our customers, but it does say that nationally we're blessed in that we've taken on some costs, and therefore our trend line is pretty good. And as you know, the trend line at the Bureau of Environmental Services is quite good, and that's why this year they're down around 3.4 to 3.6 in terms of a rate increase, proposed rate increase. So, given that we have a structural advantage in that we can cover these costs going forward, given that we enjoy very high credit ratings, and given that compared to other cities, we're a relative bargain, I still think we're more green than yellow, but I understand that yellow is because of your inherent caution as CFO.
And I also couldn't figure out a way, Commissioner, to split the bubble into green and yellow. So I am cautious, but I agree with you that we've gone, if we were had not accomplished the things that you referenced, it would be a much different picture for us. And I do think that the plans that we're on means that we're going to be able to sustain those systems. But I do know that we would like to have capacity for the unknowns, and that's a bit of the caution there. Contrasting that with transportation, it's no surprise that we're not spending enough money now, and going forward, that trend doesn't look like it's going to get a lot better very quickly. So I'm very concerned about our ability to fund all of our transportation needs. I have another category, which is things like parks and public
safety.
Mr. Rest,
I just want to tell you that I was so alarmed by these red circles for transportation that I realize is really short notice, but I propose that we send the voters transportation funding mechanism this afternoon.
And we didn't plan it that way, but it looks like it's working out very nicely.
It is everything.
The other category really is parks, our civic assets, like these kinds of buildings, the Portland Building, technology, public safety, and even housing. And we're making a lot of progress on that, and we're spending a lot of making many investments in that area. But those needs are growing, and I'm concerned about our ability to fund that with the methods that we typically use, which are GO bonds and the general fund, et cetera. Another category that I have in here is what I call legacy liabilities, and that's dealing with the cost of remediating the city's portion of the cost associated with Portland Harbor. We have a Columbia River levees project that may have costs coming back to us. I have it in red status mostly because I don't know how big that is, but it could be a big number, and we don't know how we're going to pay for it yet. We don't know who's responsible with inside our city organization, so that makes me concerned. And then finally, on employee costs, we're really at a position where those employee costs are beginning to grow faster than the rate of growth in our revenues. We have recent bargaining agreement changes that are increasing our employee costs. The PERS-related expense, for example, approximately $39 million ongoing new costs coming our way. 40% of that's general fund. That's $16 million ongoing. Now, the CBO has some of that built into the forecast. Not all of it's built into the forecast. PERS collars things, and it will attenuate when we see it. But if you're going to wonder why we don't have any money for infrastructure investment each year, even if revenues are growing, it's because of things like PERS. So speaking of revenue, how's our revenue picture? Over the last couple of years in particular, we've had extremely strong general fund revenue growth. Almost couldn't be any stronger, and we should see some continued benefits from that, particularly with unwinding some of the compression that affects our property tax revenues. Business license tax and transient lodging tax are at all-time highs. We may see some limited upside, but frankly, at this stage of the economic cycle, it's probably more of a likelihood that we'll see them flatten or fall if we run into a recession. Our utility license fees are kind of flat, which really represents, you know, people ditching landlines and us losing revenue associated with those companies that provide landline services on the telecom side. And I know we've had a lot of discussions about future urban renewal tax increment revenues coming back to the city and other governments, but really, that's really 10 years away or longer. So those are really revenues over the horizon, not going to help us in the short run. So what's our outlook for new revenues? I do think that our strategy of going to the voters periodically for voter-approved GO bonds to fund parks improvements or public safety improvements is a good strategy and one that we will be successful with. Our ability to have a new funding program for transportation remains to be seen. I'm optimistic that this afternoon is a step in that direction, but I have a question about whether we'll be successful with that. And I think we're going to have to consider some of the other revenue ideas that have been considered in the past. For example, we've discussed about imposing a utility license fee on cell phone users, much like we impose on landline users, one, to increase our revenues, but also to make it fair between the users of telecom services. Why should those who have a landline pay and those who don't not pay? And finally, the easiest source of money for us, new revenue, is simply to have people pay what's already owed to us. We know we don't collect all the business license taxes. We know we have liens outstanding that we haven't chosen to foreclose on for policy reasons. We have a large number of uncollected parking revenues. If we spent more effort collecting the low-hanging fruit, in fact, the fruit that's on the ground, you know, that would help close this gap as well.
On the uncollected parking citations, I just want to note that we've been working with PBOT has been trying to figure out mechanisms to improve collections. We're having lengthy conversations with the court system, which is deeply involved in that. I'm hoping in the next few months we're going to have some proposals that will help address that backlog.
Good news. Thank you. Bottom line for the city, it's a math problem. Our expenses, operating capital, are simply growing faster than revenues. It's a systemic problem. It's going to take a systemic solution, and we know what that means. It means cutting our costs. It means cutting our services, increasing our revenues, or some combination of the above. If we don't take action, what we're going to be in a situation, I believe, is just chronic budget shortfalls and reductions. This year is a really good instructive lesson. Revenues are growing, and we're asking bureaus to cut budgets. Why? Because we'd like to add new services and devote more resources to housing. Nothing wrong with that. But when we add more programs and we have cost push from these other things, our revenues, even when they're growing, aren't growing enough. And that means we're limited in our ability to make more investments in infrastructure. It puts pressure on our reserve levels and the kinds of things that, if we're not careful with how we approach that, we will be in this situation every year. We'll default to the easy, thin-the-soup kind of budget cutting across the board. So we get to the point where no one likes what we're serving because it's not a very tasty meal any longer. And what I'm mostly concerned about is avoiding things that create a financial impairment for us going forward. Now, we've had many challenges financially over the years, and we've rose to those challenges. And so we're at a point now where, depending on what we do in terms of policy and practice, will affect whether or not we maintain the integrity that we currently enjoy or not. But that's the challenge that lies ahead of us. So I'd just like to summarize, you know, where we started with the CAFR. The good news is that the CAFR for the fiscal year ending 2015 meets all of our required accounting standards. We have an unmodified or clean opinion from our external auditors. No audit deficiencies noted by our auditors as well. Our current financial position is strong. Michelle mentioned the fact that our general fund balances continue to grow. So that's good news as well for us. I think it's important that we do make adjustments to the GAAP presentation of net position because it tells us a better picture and story about where we're at financially. And frankly, it's the story that investors and the bond rating community uses at assessing our financial health. The CAFR is simply a financial snapshot at a point in time, and we know that we have future challenges that will affect our city's fiscal health. I'm confident that by working together, we can avoid those problems that we see other governments falling into and be able to maintain our ability to deliver the services without future financial impairment.
And one other question that this your excellent presentation sort of begs is, are there any changes that you're likely to propose in how we do planning in light of this data? And I'm thinking, for example, you know, currently we think in terms of a five-year horizon. The Independent Budget Office provides a five-year projection. No one has a crystal ball, so we don't know, you know, when a recession is going to hit and how long it's going to be, and there's other things that we can't quite anticipate. But, for example, is a five-year lookout adequate, or are you likely to come back to us at some point and say we need a longer horizon? And are there any other potential changes in sort of fostering this long-term look at this structural challenge?
It's a good question, Commissioner. You know, going beyond 5 years is always complicated because the accuracy and the validity of the information becomes more challenging the longer you go out. I think one of the ways to think of it is rather than so much trying to get more clarity about the future is try to set policy and practice around things that we know will affect the future. So, for example, one of the big drivers for cities like Portland is the rate of growth in personal services. Our costs are largely people costs. What's our policy about allowing that rate of growth to increase above inflation or above a certain benchmark number? What can we do to try to better manage that? What are the things that we're going to have to wrestle with? Because if we don't wrestle with that, what we're saying is that we're going to allow that big driver of cost to be whatever it is, and we're going to try to make it up on the other side. I think some discussion around that could be helpful. I think some discussion around how we're going to approach funding capital infrastructure liabilities, that we start looking at creating dedicated sources of funding to that so it's not competing and is the thing that we don't do when we're trying to assess how we balance our budget would be helpful. And I think also we have to have more discipline about new programs and activities that we add. If we're going to add things, what are we not going to be able to do? And we tend to take on everything, and everything before that is also taken on. And at some point, it's going to be very difficult to carry that entire burden going forward. We don't do a very good job of asking ourselves about trade-offs and trying to manage within that more constrained set of revenue. So don't have precise answers, but those are three areas that I think need more attention, and I think in working with Andrew in the seat in his office could come back to you with some more structure around that.
Great. Other questions for our team? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So let's take testimony on this item, and then I might, before we call on the auditor for the second item, bring up the folks to deal with those items on consent that we needed questions answered about. So anyone want to speak on this item, item number 77?
Okay. No one signed up.
Oh, come on.
Yes, my name is Lightning. I represent Lightning Watchdog PDX. I thought the presentation was really good. Gave a clear understanding on the pensions and how the accounting procedures are looking at it at this time for the benefit of the investors maybe purchasing bonds in the future. Now, one of the issues I have, again, is that on some of the legacy, per se, projects, again, such as the Columbia River levee is what I've been speaking on for quite a long time, and I think that a lot of people are overlooking just how important of an issue that is at this time. We're done doing patchwork on the levee. In my opinion, we need to start looking at building new, which would be toward the new infrastructure. And in my opinion, that will be one of the largest construction projects in Portland, Multnomah County. And I want to really focus on that, on the dollar amounts that would cost to rebuild that over time in different phases. Another issue I have, obviously, listening to this, is that on the transportation gas tax, it's my understanding a lot of that money would be used for more of the repair side on the streets, and it sounds to me like we're talking about the best thing to do would be to possibly build new streets for the infrastructure. And that's something that I questioned this time, to have a clear understanding on, if we pass that gas tax, where's that money going to be applied and where's the best direction to apply that money, especially when we're looking at this type of accounting that we're seeing today. So again, and just a little more clarity, I guess, on making sure that, and I've talked in the past, that any loans or grants given out to people, especially on the loans, we want to make sure those are repaid back. We don't want to convert those to grants if they can't make the payments. And I want to see that tightened up immediately on this in any future grants. Obviously, by this presentation, I would look at everything very close on who receives that money, because it appears as though we're going to, like I say, have more expenses accruing than income, and we're going to have to start looking at areas to change that immediately. And again, I want to commend you, Mayor Hales, on creating a surplus budget. The last mayor did not do that. You did that. You will leave probably creating a surplus budget, so I commend you on your efforts on that.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good, thank you. That was an accident. My name is Joe Walsh. I represent Individuals for Justice. I was curious. I didn't hear all of the report, because from time to time I have to use the restroom. So I missed some of it. But the part that I heard, the thought went through my head, you know, it would be really nice if we got these reports and on the top it would say, the drain on our budget is. You know, the biggest drain on our budget is. I get really nervous when bureaucrats say to me, hey, everything's okay. We're in compliance. We're doing a good job. We're patting each other on the back. Makes me very nervous. Because you just had a newspaper article blasting you on your grants. So how could everything be okay? I'm not an economist. However, I know this. People that are watching this, people that read about this, people that will hear about this, want to understand it, and they don't. I've attended 482 meetings, and I don't understand it. And I have a bachelor's degree. That gives you some sense of what you're doing. That's why you get an F in transparency, because the citizens do not understand it. When you do these reports, would you please say, look, we're having a lot of trouble with transportation, or we're having a lot of trouble with the parks. redline it. When I do a budget at home and something's coming up, I put it in red. I said, this is a big concern. We have a trip to California and we have no money. We have to do something about this. Everything is okay? Everything's fine? No, it isn't. You know that, and I know that. People watching this television do not understand what's going on. Thank you.
Joe, I think you may have been out of the room when Ken showed us a red, yellow, green chart that actually did
yeah,
a pretty good job.
Yeah, I actually didn't see that.
Yeah, that's a really good translation of where we are into those kind of more understandable terms.
If you can look at that and you can see the problems right away,
yeah.
Then I commend you on it.
Yeah.
I didn't see that. We're not privileged to that kind of information.
Yeah,
we have very limited stuff that we can look at.
Yeah, you know, he put that up on the screen so people got to see that. I know, but it's out there.
Okay, so I commend you on that. Also, I don't like it when bureaucrats say everything is okay, because it's not. It's an ongoing problem. And we know at least two bureaus are in trouble, and they're on my left, which makes me nervous. They should be on my right. Transportation and parks have admitted that they need more money. So everything is not all right.
Thank you.
Mayor, I move the report.
Is there a second?
Second.
Discussion? Roll call, please.
Fritz?
Well, congratulations to our city controller, Michelle Kirby, for completing the CAFR quicker than it's been done for quite some time, and the entire team. I'm so glad that we have a group of people who understand absolutely everything and way beyond what was in the presentation, and knowing that your team has diligently looked into everything and made a very good attempt, I think, to explain it in ways that most of us, or some of us, can understand. So well done, Michelle, Ken Rust, and Fred Miller for this report. Thanks also to James Lanzarotta, our outside auditor, for his work reviewing the CAFR. It's always important to make sure that we have outside eyes on it. So it's very clear we are not in good shape, and that I appreciate the very clear presentation that says that. We are not expecting to get a whole lot more money anytime in the foreseeable future, and we have a lot of expenditures. And the cut that we've been asked to put forward this budget season of 5% has illustrated that Portlanders really love the services that they get, and they want a lot of services. And so there isn't anything in parks, for example, that can be cut without somebody. First of all, a lot of people will lose their jobs. But second of all, there are services that people really love, and reducing pool hours or any of the other 19 strategies that we put forward in the parks proposal, many of them are really, really difficult. So it's collectively, we as a community need to decide what do we want to pay for and how do we want to pay for it. And then we have to say, we can't do some of the other things. And yes, we do need to, I think, stop this year doing outside grants. There are lots of other good things that need to be done in our community. And as we just saw, if it doesn't translate into an asset that's owned by the city, it counts against our net viability. So it's going to be a very difficult budget season. I really appreciate the presentation, which allows more folks in the community to understand that why we have a problem as well as what the problems are. And I also particularly appreciate the focus on basic maintenance, and we'll continue to work on that. Thank you very much.
I want to thank the controller and the CFO for an outstanding presentation. And what struck me is that there's no sugarcoating or pulling of punches. In fact, if you look at page 5, there's the good news and the not so good news. I think I understand the difference. And on page 11, you color code the long-term challenges, and there are a lot of red dots. So I think you've been admirably transparent about the structural issues that we deal with and the challenges we face. It's one of the reasons that I felt so strongly, by the way, that we have an independent chief financial officer for the city of Portland. And it's precisely presentations like this that, to me, vindicate the idea of having a CFO. complementing the work of our controller. Now, I'm trying to figure out what the FASB rule really, excuse me, the GASB 68 rule is really about. But I came up with a homey analogy, and it may not work, but I'm going to try it out anyway. My financial balance sheet is a little shaky, partly because I have two kids, and we borrowed a little bit against our house, and we just had one child come through college, and we're now getting her positioned for the future. But I have a 12-year-old at home, and I'm starting to think about, you know, when he gets out of, he's now in middle school, he's going to go to high school, and he's going to go to college. So I'm not sure it's a perfect analogy, but let's say that I was required to put on my balance sheet the expected cost of my son's education if he is fortunate enough to be admitted to a private institution, but wasn't allowed to book any of the other side of the ledger was bare in terms of how I'm going to pay for it. Well, the way I'm going to pay for it is I'm going to have to work for the rest of my life to have a revenue stream to cover those costs. It seems to me that's not completely dissimilar from what we're talking about here. The difference is we have a very stable revenue source to cover our pension obligations because it's legally enshrined in the charter and the public has accepted it. We have a pay-as-we-go. I don't have any job security. So I don't know, counting on my wife continuing to be successful. But so I think it is important to look at both the chart you gave us at page 7, which shows the impact of booking these pension obligations without any funding, and the Ken Rusk adjustment on page 9, which shows if you take that out, because it's two different stories. But still, you have identified for us long-term structural issues that we have to grapple with. Unlike the federal government, we can't solve it by borrowing. So we can't just declare all these are wonderful things and then borrow billions of dollars to cover it. So we're going to have to figure out how to right-size our services. And as Commissioner Fritz pointed out, the public is very clear. They want certain services. And it's also pretty clear we have a structural issue in terms of adequate revenues to meet those services. So we've got some hard work to do in thinking about the long term and the structural balance. But I have to say I'm heartened by the quality of the team that's guiding us. And I'm pleased that on the things that really matter outside of the structural issues, we get high marks for the way we do our budgeting, for the transparency, and the awards speak for themselves. So that's something that we take great pride that our team is recognized for doing this at a very high level. And since Commissioner Fritz mentioned grants, I can't resist. There are good grants and bad grants. And we'll have that discussion at budget time. But I don't want the good grants to get thrown out with the bad grants. And the good grants, in my opinion, are the monies we give to partners in the nonprofit world who have taken on the obligations of government and who save us a lot of money because they provide services. When we fund those partners, and we do a lot through parks and housing and other bureaus, that's called smart government. The alternative is that we would provide those services, and we can't. So we provide money to people. And the example that I think is the one that's worth celebrating, city owns 3 steam locomotives. They are part of our property. It's an anomaly that we own 3 steam locomotives, but we ought to be proud of it. And one of them was the lead locomotive on the bicentennial train that crossed the country in 1976. And the SP 4445 is a national treasure. So as long as we own these 3 steam locomotives, we have an obligation to provide a roof over their heads. Well, we don't have the resources to do that. So along came a group of public-spirited people who said, here's a deal that you can't resist. We'll raise $5 million and build a home for them. We'll operate the facility, and we'll take care of those treasured locomotives. Well, that's a pretty good deal, and we said thank you. And so we helped them find the dirt, but they did virtually everything else. Last year, in our budget process, we had $50 million of surplus. We decided to give them $150,000 towards the cost of building and operating and maintaining our three locomotives. And they raised $5 million and built the home and are operating it at no expense to government. I'm going to say that was a good grant. And I would have given them more, given that they took on a responsibility of government that we didn't have the resources to do. But they're good grants and bad grants, and I think we can make those distinctions. So anyway, thank you for a great presentation. I'm pleased to accept the report. Aye.
Novick?
I don't know that I can add much to what my colleagues have already said. I really appreciate Michelle and Ken giving us a very clear explanation of what our real problems are and what our real problems aren't, or what might seem to be problems but under the accounting rules, but actually are less concerned than the things that I identified as real problems. So thank you very much for your very clear presentation. Aye.
Ailes.
Well, as it happens, I just came back from one of the two meetings each year of the United States Conference of Mayors. And when the people that come to those conferences, mayors and city staff, they mostly roll up their sleeves and talk about problems and how are you solving that problem, how are you addressing that problem. Not much bragging is done because it's just not very polite. But if bragging were allowed, I'd have a lot to brag about. And if envy were able to be articulated, there would be a lot of mayors who'd be jealous of Portland. They'd be jealous for a lot of reasons. They'd be jealous of our transit system. They'd be jealous of our quality of life. They'd be jealous of our historic preservation, of our tree canopy, of our transit mode split, of our bicycle mode split. There's a long list of things that people come to study about Portland, and they would have reason to, and they keep doing that, including other mayors. But probably most of all, they would be jealous of our balance sheet. They would be jealous of the fact that when you do this accounting on a regular basis, which is what Ken did, not a funny money basis, but a regular basis, of where are we? There are some serious problems. We have a serious problem of transportation infrastructure that's out of date, needs to be renovated. And no, Lightning, you're right to raise that point. It wouldn't make sense for us to build more roads with very few exceptions. It would make a lot of sense for us to take better care of the ones that we have, because a dollar spent on doing that will avoid more dollars later. And we all have talked about that a lot over the last couple of years. Yes, it would make more sense. It would make a lot of sense to invest in our great city park system, again, something that other cities would be jealous of. But they would be especially jealous of the fact that this report is in a salacious way uninteresting. An extremely interesting presentation. The situation from a scandal standpoint is totally boring. The Portland for 40 years has had a AAA bond rating. I've been in presentations where our financial staff went to the rating agencies and made the case about why we should keep that bond rating. For example, right after Orange County went into default, I was in on that presentation, and we kept our AAA bond rating. So, Ken, Michelle, you and your staff continue to do a great job, as does our budget office, of making sure that we as decision makers are able to steer Portland in a responsible way and address problems like transportation and parks funding, like utility rates, in a way that is very defensible, and again, that the rest of the country would love to have our situation, and they'd love to have our balance sheet, and they'd probably also love to have our financial staff, and I hope they don't take them. Thank you very much. Aye. Okay, let's